corn of sugar mixed in my tea. That's the woman I'm loving, sweet enough for me. She's so sweet, so sweet, my little baby, so sweet. Hey, mama, hey, gal, don't you hear me calling you? Lord, how much is it? She's so sweet. So sweet, my little baby, so sweet. You see my woman coming, boys. Don't you get so smart. I will cut your liver and I will plug your heart. She's so sweet. So sweet, my little baby, so sweet. Call again. Hey, baby. Hey, gal. Don't you hear old Sonny Terry calling you? You're so sweet. So sweet. My little baby, so sweet.
Until you bring back that little girl of mine. I can't let her go. I'm hooked. I can't let her go. People try to tell me, stop crying and find you someone new. Because when the good Lord made one woman, a hallelujah, don't you know he made two? But I can't let her go. I'm hooked, I can't let her go. I can't let her go, no. No, I can't let her go. He lifted his head toward heaven and said, good Lord, I'd rather die than to let her, a no good cheating woman, make me stand on this corner and cry. Lord knows I'm living in a world of darkness, but that don't bother me until I find that sweet little girl of mine. Lord knows I just don't wanna see, but I can't. can't let her go. Let her go. Lord, I can't let her go.
All right, so we were just talking about this whole issue of police brutality, police violence committed against multiple Americans, but especially African Americans. My next guest, Philip Clay with the Project 21, claims that black media doesn't talk about a major issue like black-on-black crime. So, really, I thought that'd be real interesting. So he joins us right now. So, Philip, glad to have you here. So, how do you ascertain we don't discuss the issue of black-on-black crime?
Well, good evening, Roland, and thanks for having me on, and congratulations on your nomination for the NAACP award. So for me personally, I'd like to take the conservative out of this and really just talk to you as a young black male. From where I sit in Indiana, which has a very high crime rate when it comes to black Americans, I don't see the same outrage and instances of black on blacks, young black teens killing black teens, as I do when I see five black officers beating and killing Tyree Nichols in tragedy. Or in instances like you were just talking about earlier in Mississippi, or in the George Floyd instances. To me, the article that I wrote and the reason I'm on your show is because I feel that until we as a community can start to rally together and say no more, we can't progress. My article intends to say that we need to, as a community, come together and stop blaming police, just blaming police, and we need to stand together and we need to progress. And we need to make things happen.
What is the, so you say you're there in Indiana. What is the white-on-white crime rate in Indiana?
You know, rolling off the top of my head, I don't know that figure for you.
So I'm trying to understand if you only mentioning black-on-black crime, how do you not mention white-on-white crime? Because if we're talking about crime in this country, we've seen an explosion in the last several years of crime in rural America that doesn't involve black people.
Right. Although 89% of black people are killing other black people. There was an article. Unfortunately, I can't share my screen like you can.
Right, but the reality is, if you look at actually crime in America, it typically happens where people live. So typically, if you're black, crime is being committed by someone black, and if you're white, crime is being committed by somebody white. So why is it that no one ever mentions white on white crime? Why is it the pathology always black on black crime?
Well, I think white on white crime is mentioned. I think it
no,
is.
No, it's not. It's that phrase is never even used. It's literally never even used.
So then what's it called, Roland?
Oh, it's called, first of all, they just say crime. But what you have is you have folks who say black on black crime. So again, so what I'm saying
is
why
is population that's,
huh?
That's disproportionately affected. It is a big thing. And
I'm not saying it's not a big thing, but the reality is we do focus on what is the underlying issue of crime. So what is that? What's the underlying issue of crime?
Please tell me.
Huh?
Please tell me.
You don't know?
No, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
No, first of all, if you're going to write about how we should be focusing on crime, then you might want to be talking about what is the underlying issue of crime. John Hope Bryant talks all the time that you've never seen a riot in a community where the credit score is 700 or higher. I was just in Wichita, Kansas, the MLK event, and the former police chief of Philadelphia, the police chief of Wichita who came to Philadelphia, we were discussing this, and the reality is you can track crime rates in neighborhoods based upon economic status. And so if you say we don't address the issue of crime, we do, because on this show, we consistently are talking about economics. We're talking about education. We're talking about access to capital. We're talking about housing. We're talking about all of those issues. Those are the fundamental underpinnings of crime in America.
Right. So I'm not sure if you read the article or not, but at the end of it, it does say that it's a community issue. We as a community have to fix this. But I don't think, like your last panelist was saying, by just vilifying police and saying that all the police are bad. And
I'm sorry, who said that?
I believe it was Reese.
No, she didn't. Reese didn't say all the police were bad. We were very specific about what cops we're talking about. And so if we're talking about cops, because you talk about a disproportionate rate, the fact of the matter is we see it where cops do lie. in your neighboring Chicago, there was a judge who got so sick and tired of cops lying on the witness stand that he literally reported them to the Citizens Accountability, saying, I will not allow these cops to come back in here. You have district attorneys in Prince George's County and also in Chicago. They have lists of cops who they will not let testify because they are known to lie. So why can't we hold cops accountable for also committing crimes and lying and making things up in police reports? And we will talk about what happens in the neighborhoods. Why can't we hold them accountable? They got badges and guns.
No one's saying that we can't hold them accountable. And I want to make that clear. And the article doesn't say that we can't hold them accountable. The article clearly says that good cops call out bad cops. And despite all—
I'm sorry, you said good cops call out bad cops?
Good cops call out bad cops.
That's a lie.
It's literally a lie.
We saw right there in Memphis where so were there any good cops who showed up? We played a video yesterday in Chicago where these two cops were beating this guy in a jail cell. Two other folks just stood there and watched them. We've shown a video on this show from Los Angeles, from Mississippi, from South Carolina, from North Carolina, from Philadelphia, from Detroit, where cops stand back and watch these things unfold, and they will actually back up the lying cop in police reports. So please show me where there's this swell or this groundswell of good cops reporting bad cops.
Rowan, you and I agree on that subject, that those people are not good cops, the people that stand by idly and don't do anything. In doing research for the article, unfortunately enough, last year I had the chance to work with my local police department to understand what goes into being a police officer, because I wanted to know for myself what it takes to become a police officer. One of the things that was taught, one of the core things, was that not only is use of force a last resort, but you're also taught to de-escalate your partner when your partner becomes too emotionally involved or too attached to whatever's happening.
How often have you seen that? How often, when you've seen a lot of these video footages? Now, I've seen de-escalation when the person's white. I've seen a whole lot of de-escalation. But typically, when I'm seeing body cam footage and it's somebody black, I'm seeing an escalation of tensions. And so please give me some examples where de-escalation is often happening.
You're talking about the videos that have been seen. What about the thousands that haven't been released because there was a successful de-escalation or there was a successful stoppage of whatever was happening?
Or the examples where the cops didn't turn the cameras on, and where in Chicago they were breaking the antennas off of the dash cam cameras as well. I mean, again, the point here is, again, we're still talking about a fundamental problem in this country. Last year, police in America, based upon the data, Samuel Sengawe, we had him on the show, they killed more people in 2022 than any other point in history. We have seen a dramatic increase of police violence. We have seen insurance companies come out and say that they are going to stop insuring cities, or they're going to actually raise their rates because of the high number of police violence cases. And so I'm trying to understand, you want to talk about black on black crime as a conservative. Here's what I want to know. Where are all of the fiscal conservatives complaining about the millions upon millions and billions being spent on police settlements?
That's a good question, Roland.
They're not there. I guess who I don't see? I don't see Grover Norquist. I don't see, let me tell you something. Memphis is probably going to pay $20, $30, $40 million settlement. It's likely going to be higher than the George Floyd settlement. Do you know who I have not heard a lot on this? Governor of Tennessee, the Tennessee legislature. I've not heard Republicans in that state say this is gross and it's unfair. What you do see, though, you typically will see Democrats or you see the Black Caucus. What I'm still trying to say to you, we have on this show and in other black media discussions about black on black crime. What we don't do is fall for the pathology of Fox News and other places. We talk about what creates those conditions and what must be done to change those neighborhoods. And so what I want to know is, how are you in Project 21 advancing those issues and then calling on your fellow conservatives to support those very issues?
Absolutely. I've spent the past couple of days being able to do press about this issue specifically. And the thing that's come out of it, and the thing I will stick to, is we have to be transparent, both in the community and on behalf of police departments or police departments themselves. There has to be open dialogue, and police departments have to show that whatever's being accused against them, levied against them, is not true. And the good cops do have to weed out the bad cops. And I understand that your thoughts on that, and you've made that point clear. But at the end of the day, there are still people that wake up every morning with their intention and their honor, and all they want to do is protect the people in the community in which they live and serve.
But where are those? Why is it that when we need those good cops to show up, we don't seem to see them? And why is it? Because, again, I've talked to many officers, and I've talked to black officers, and I've had black officers tell me the safest they are is when they got a uniform on. They say, but damn, when I don't have my uniform on, I don't trust my own department. Those are black cops.
That's a departmental issue, and until people can actually go into those communities and start having those conversations and weeding out those bad chiefs of police, those bad officers, and working through that, it's going to continue to be the same.
You do know that there have been reports showing the number of white supremacists that have infiltrated police departments nationwide, right?
Yes.
Okay. You've seen the reports, again, of message boards and various Facebook groups where you've had these racist cops making comments, things along those lines. In Chicago, there were cops who admitted, yeah, we call folks the N-word. We freely throw it around. So if you're a black person in a Chicago community, why would you trust a racist cop? Hold on, I gotta pay some bills. Philip, I asked the question, if you're in a neighborhood and you have had bad encounters with cops and you know you're dealing with racist cops in those areas, how can you trust them?
I don't think you can, but I guess the question, my question back to you is what do you do in that situation? What would you, Roland Martin, do in that situation if you can't trust the cops in your neighborhood?
I'm not dealing with them, because here's the deal. I lived in Chicago 6 years, okay? I have seen examples where the cops planted evidence, where they beat confessions out of people. Chicago had to pay upwards of $40 million in reparations to a number of black people who were beaten, who actually were electrocuted, their testicles, by Captain John Burge and those racists in the department. Chicago actually had a Holman Street location where they were holding people, depriving them of their due rights. Attorneys didn't even know where their clients were being taken. They had, when the consent decree came down in Chicago, they admitted, oh yeah, we use the N-word. They admitted driving gang members from one territory to another and dropping them off to see if they actually lived, okay? We saw, again, under Trump, where Sessions tried to get rid of the consent decree in Baltimore. Cleveland's been under two consent decrees. But again, if we're gonna have a discussion about black-on-black crime, let's also at least say white-on-white crime, but let's deal with the issue of how do you address crime? You do not address crime with policing. You have to address crime in a holistic way. And unfortunately, Philip, Republicans and conservatives do not want to do that in this country. It's a matter of more jails, more police, more funding. Let's increase the funding, but not deal with the fundamental underpinning of crime in neighborhoods, which is poverty.
Again, I ask if you read my article, because at the end of it, again, I do say the only way that this works is if we as a community come together and try to fix this morally bankrupt system.
But why is it at the end of your article and not the beginning of your article?
It's throughout, Roland. There's a lot to unpack in what happened. There's a lot to unpack in what happened in Mississippi. Or, I'm sorry, not Mississippi, in Memphis.
Bob, let me go to my panel. Let's see, Reese, since he name-checked you, you get the first question or comment.
Those on Medicare could be eligible for a healthy grocery allowance up to $900. That is available now with a Medicare Advantage plan. The healthy grocery benefit could pay up to $900 for you to spend on groceries in participating stores for approved items. That's right. The healthy food allowance pays up to $900 for you to spend in the store.
If you're on Medicare, call 1-844-412-4281 for free today and see how much you can claim.
I use my allowance from everything from meat to vegetables, as long as it's healthy.
It's a huge improvement on my last plan, and now I have that little bit of extra at the end of each month.
If you're on Medicare, Call 1-844-412-4281 for free today and see how much you can claim. That's 1-844-412-4281.
Yes, I actually did read the article, and I have to say, I think it's appalling to use the brutal death of Tyre Nichols to advance propaganda as Black people as violent. I listened for the past 10 minutes without, you know, whatever. So anyway, so you compared the cops to gang violence, which is more coded language, anti-Black coded language. And I do agree with you on that, though, because the police departments, like the ones that are out of control and need consent decrees, which as a member of Project 21, I'm sure you know that in their Black agenda is to do away with consent decrees, that the police officers often are like gang members. This just so happens to be Black gang members that are in the police department, and they just so happen to not get the protection of that blue line. But to your point that Black people don't care about Black on Black crime, that is completely false. I lived like Roland, I lived in Chicago, where every summer, and I'm appalled by violence, period, regardless of the race. But every summer, as soon as it got over 50 degrees on the radio all day, all you hear on every single radio station is stop the violence, leave the guns at home, don't kill anybody, don't shoot anybody. I remember very vividly when Hadiya Pendleton, a young lady, a young teenager, went to the White House went to the Obama inauguration, and she was gunned down in Hyde Park, and First Lady Michelle Obama actually went to her funeral. And so this whole notion that Black people don't care about crime within our race is even more anti-Black and white supremacist. But my question to you is, how do you reconcile this notion that cops are inherently good and that we need to weed out the few bad rotten apples if you are part of a project that wants to do away with consent decrees and wants to federally enshrine qualified immunity?
What I've been saying in this article, what I will continue to say, is at the end of the day, there are men and women who wake up every day who want nothing more than to serve and protect the communities in which they live in. That has been my stance. That will continue to be my stance. Black conservative, white conservative, Black Democrat, white Democrat, whatever. That's my stance.
Okay, so but before I go to Erica, I have your article up. Go to my iPad, please. So here's the deal. Your article, you talk about working with local cops. Then you talk about you're not naive that your hometown in Indiana is Memphis. Then in your third paragraph, first of all, you talk about de-escalation. In your third paragraph, you say, I ask myself, though, where's the outrage for all Black-on-Black crime? Why are leaders in the community like Al Sharpton not vocal about the children who are killed in Black-on-Black crime on a daily basis in places like Chicago? Well, first of all, that's a lie. I do know for a fact he's talked about it, even moved there for a time. I do know people who have marches and rallies in Chicago. I've covered them. I don't know if Project 21 has. And then you go on, you say, as these leaders continue to vilify police and cause tensions to rise, how are they causing tensions to rise when it's the cops who's actually killing people? They set these communities and the police who are sworn to protect them back another step. Really? Then you go in and complain about CNN. Then you talk about mirror gang violence. Then you go talk about we still see men and women of all races, religions and creeds going to work to protect the communities, blah, 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 blah. Then you get... this is what you keep talking about at the end of your article. This is literally what you wrote in the article, because I swore that there was some other stuff down here. That's where that white space is, because I thought there was more to it. This is literally all you said. We have to raise up the officers who are doing their utmost to defend and protect and work to weed out those who would break their oath. We have to stop looking to put the blame on everyone else and start looking at giving real leaders a chance to rebuild our morally decayed community. So in the third paragraph, you mentioned Black-on-Black crime. In the last sentence, the last half of the last sentence, you say, we have to stop looking to put the blame on everyone else and start looking at giving real leaders a chance to rebuild a morally decayed community. You literally say nothing about why there's Black-on-Black crime. You literally don't even, like, I'm looking for it. I'm trying to see, do I see poverty? No. Do I see education? No. Do I see lack of economic advancement? No. Your entire piece is really about, oh my goodness, we've got some really great, wonderful cops. So how can you make it about black-on-black crime when you don't even address the issue of the underpinning of black-on-black crime in your entire piece?
Again, Roland, my position is and will continue to be that I don't see protests in the street for children being killed in Chicago.
You're a lie. I'm sorry. If you don't see it, Philip, that's because you choose not to see it. They have been protests. First of all, here's the question. Where are you in Indiana?
Indianapolis.
When last time you been to Chicago?
I typically don't go to Chicago.
Gotcha. So you don't go to Chicago. So no, do you follow any Chicago media?
No. What incentive do I have?
No, wait. Do you know any activists in Chicago?
Yes.
Do you know any community leaders in Chicago?
I know community leaders in Gary, Indiana.
No. I didn't say Gary, Indiana. I said Chicago. Chicago is not Gary, Indiana.
Deontay Johnson, Black Conservative Federation.
Ah, you got Deontay. Oh, that idiot? Hold up, wait. Are you sick? That's who you claiming? Dude, don't even try that one. Here's the problem with what you said. You just said, quote, I don't see any protests in Chicago of black on black. You don't know anybody in Chicago. You haven't even been there. This is the problem when you say, I haven't seen it. If you ain't been there and you don't know anybody and you likely don't follow them on social media, you wouldn't see it. But the reality is, it does exist. So, Philip, never ever come on television and say, well, I don't see it, if your eyes are closed because you never opened them. We have literally had the people on this show live from protests. So for you to say, well, I don't see it, you try to act like it doesn't exist. It does. So if you've never made the effort to find out that they are protesting, how can you then criticize folk for saying they're not protesting?
I was down to talk to my doctor about Rybelsus.
Ask your healthcare provider about Rybelsus today.
I don't know what you're trying to accomplish.
Philip, let me help you out with something. Let me just help you out with something, Philip.
Usually I ask for help if I need.
No, because you need some help right now, Philip. Like, you need some help real bad. If I said I have never ever seen Philip in a red tie, and if somebody says, Roland, have you ever met Philip? No. Have you ever seen Philip on TV? No. Have you ever seen Philip at an event? No. Well, hell, if you ain't never seen Philip, of course you ain't never seen Philip in a red tie. So how can you say people are not protesting black-on-black violence in Chicago, but they are, but, oh, you haven't seen it, and you've made no attempt to find out it exists? But let me ask you this question, and I want you to answer that one too, for why are you so worried about Chicago? And you ain't focused on crime in Indianapolis.
You are focused on crime in Indianapolis.
So why are you bringing up Chicago, though? Because I'm sorry. Go back to my iPad. I'm looking at your column. You simply state, I've had the opportunity to work with my local police department. You don't name it. You say, I'm not naive enough to equate my hometown in Indiana to Memphis. You don't name your hometown. And so why is it that, again, third paragraph, right here, why are leaders in the community, like Al Sharpton, not vocal about the children who are killed in black-on-black crime on a daily basis in places like Chicago? Why didn't you mention your city?
I mentioned Indianapolis in all the radio interviews I've done.
No. Why didn't you mention your crime in your city in your column? All right, let me do this better. Philip, what are you doing to solve the crime issue in Indianapolis? I want to hear specifics.
Working with local police departments to bridge the gap between the police and the community.
How? What are you doing in the community? I get the cop part. Has the community ever seen you?
Yes.
What communities?
Indianapolis.
No. What communities in Indianapolis?
I literally just said that. Indianapolis, Marion County as a whole, Plainfield, Avon, Brownsburg, Danville, Johnson County.
And what are you doing? What are you doing in those communities?
Working to improve police.
Like what? No. But what are you doing? Like when you say working, have you had to have you had community-based town halls, not the cops, the community.
Yeah.
When?
Yeah. Yeah.
When?
Yeah. 2020.
No, when?
What, do you want exact dates, Roland? I don't have my iPad.
No. I want to know when. Because, see, I know people in Indianapolis. I've spoken to them many times. I'm going to call them, and I'm going to find out. I'm going to say, hey, have y'all ever seen Philip? I'm going to call him. Have you ever seen Philip? Has Philip ever come around? Because, see, you keep saying you putting in the work. So, okay, how about this here? In the last year, how many community-based town halls have you actually held or attended community-based town halls in Indianapolis? Not cops, the community. How many?
I've not been at any in the last year.
Whoa, stop. Hold up. See, now, I'm up against a break. I'm going to hold you over for one more because, see, I'm trying to figure out you all this work you say you're doing. I need to know what that work is, because if you say you want to fix Chicago and you ain't had not now in a year in Indianapolis, not one. OK, hold on. We'll be right back on Roland Martin. See, Philip, you want to have the conversation on Black Owned Media. Oh, you having it. We'll be right back. No, we'll be right back, Philip. I'm going to give you some time, Philip. We'll be right back.
No, because it's not even a conversation.
I'm going to give you some time, Philip.
At this point, it's not even a conversation.
Most people. See, I told y'all. See? Don't mess with a grown-ass man. Philip didn't do his homework. See, Philip went on other people's shows who didn't question him. They didn't actually break down his article. I'm about to go to Erica and Michael. But see, oh, by the way, y'all, you know Philip hung up. You know Philip hung up. He hung up. And they've been calling him back, texting him. And I said, let him know he can talk for the first 2 minutes. But Philip hung up because he couldn't take that heat. Because see, y'all, see, what happens is, see, Philip, the basis of his, see, y'all got to understand. The basis of Philip's article, y'all don't discuss black-on-black crime. Okay, you want to have that conversation, Philip? Let's have that conversation. And y'all heard he kept saying, no, but I said at the end of my article, we as a community, we got to come together and solve the problem. Oh, but then when I asked Philip, when has the community seen you? Philip, well, I work with the cops, not the community. Oh, Philip, when did you last work with the community? Any town halls in last year? No. What the hell you been doing? See, Erica, they don't like getting questioned on specifics. See, he was like, oh, you ain't let me talk. No, I let you talk because you can't answer my questions. That's the real deal. He couldn't answer the questions because he thought he was going to come on here and talk about how black media don't do this, and y'all don't discuss black on black crime, until I start questioning on what he ain't
doing. Period.
World Media Network honors the only heavyweight boxer to win the title 3 times and arguably the greatest boxer of all time. Muhammad Ali, born Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr. on January 17, 1942. Was an American boxer and former 3-time world heavyweight champion. Ali remains the only man to have won the linear heavyweight championship 3 times. The linear title is recognized by tracing an almost unbroken lineage of title holders going back over 100 years, with nearly every champion defeating the previous title holder in the ring. Ali also won an Olympic light heavyweight gold medal. In 1999, Muhammad Ali was crowned Sportsman of the Century by Sports Illustrated and the BBC. Cassius Marcellus Clay, Jr., was born in Louisville, Kentucky. He was named after his father, Cassius Marcellus Clay, who was named after the 19th century abolitionist and politician Cassius Clay. Ali changed his name after joining the Nation of Islam in 1964. Ali was known for his fighting style. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. He made a name for himself throughout his career with excellent hand speed, swift feet, and taunting tactics. In 1967, America was at war with Vietnam. When Ali got his draft notice, he arrived as instructed for the physical exam and cooperated politely until it was time to take the Army oath. He refused, saying, I ain't got no quarrel with them. Viet Cong. A month later, an all-white jury found him guilty of draft evasion, and Ali was in prison. His boxing license was revoked, and he was stripped of his world championship. Almost 4 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned his conviction and decided that under the tenets of Islam, Ali was a conscientious objector, not a criminal. On March 8, 1971, Ali met Joe Frazier in the ring at Madison Square Garden, the fight known as the Fight of the Century. It was one of the most eagerly anticipated bouts of all time and remains one of the most famous. Frazier punctuated his victory by flooring Ali with a hard left hook in the 15th and final round. Frazier retained the title unanimously, dealing Ali with his first professional loss. However, in 1974, Ali fought a rematch against Frazier, and Ali unanimously won that match. Later that same year, Ali defeated George Foreman, what most thought would be seemingly unbeatable. Muhammad Ali defeated almost every top heavyweight in his era, called the Golden Age of Heavyweight Boxing. Ali was named Fighter of the Year by Ring Magazine more times than any other fighter. Muhammad Ali retired after being beaten by Larry Holmes in 1980. 4 years later, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's syndrome. Despite the disability, perhaps because of it, he was a beloved and active public figure for decades. On July 27, 2012, Ali was the titular bearer of the Olympic flag during the opening ceremonies of the 2012 Summer Olympics in London. He was helped to his feet by his wife Lonnie to stand before the flag due to his Parkinson's syndrome, rendering him unable to carry it into the stadium. The same year, he was awarded the Philadelphia Liberty Medal for his lifelong activism, philanthropy, and humanitarian efforts. He was hospitalized in 2016 with a respiratory illness that worsened and claimed his life from septic shock. He was 74 years old. Ali was known for being a humanitarian and philanthropist. He focused on practicing his Islamic duty of charity and good deeds, donating millions to charity organizations and disadvantaged people of all religious and ethnic backgrounds. It is estimated that Ali helped to feed more than 22 million people afflicted by hunger across the world. Another extraordinary contribution to Black history. This is the Black World Media Network.
Florida is, well, would like to think of itself, I think, as leading the charge in restricting the teaching of materials in schools that make MAGA Governor Ron DeSantis feel uncomfortable. That crusade is being championed all across the country and other states as well. As we showed you, one school board in Colorado has a big problem with author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates reading a book from one of his, quote, from one of his books at a meeting stripped of context as a sort of condemnation of critical examinations of race in America. So I would like to bring in the author himself, Ta-Nehisi Coates, winner of the National Book Award, MacArthur Fellowship, author of several best-selling books, including the one in question, Between the World and Me. Good to have you here.
Thank you. And thank you for that introduction. Well, that was really kind.
It was all true. What do you think, what goes through your head when you see like this star chamber type interrogation of your text and a teacher before a school board having to defend a single quote from it?
I thank God that the guy asking the question isn't a teacher. look, you can pull a sentence out of any text and say, you know, what do you think of this? You know, obviously, you know, one of the big arguments of Between the World and Me is that race is a social fiction. So when we say white people will cease to exist, the idea is the category will too. And racially, the hope would be that Black people would too. You know what I mean? Which is, you know, the case that the story makes. It does not mean that white people will be physically eradicated from the face of the earth. But, you know, if somebody wants to do that, they can do it.
Well, and it also, I mean, the other thing that it strikes me with that quote and about the way that you write about race, both in Between the World and Me and in your novel, there's a phrase you use, people that think they're white or believe that they're white, that it is a belief. It is a belief system. Right. It is a social construct and is a way of people constructing a social reality together that is imbued with history and material consequences. But fundamentally, it isn't actually a biological reality.
Yeah, and that's the argument that's being made. And actually, I think the elements of that belief system can be seen in this slate of laws. Take, for example, this notion that students should not be exposed to anything that makes them feel uncomfortable, discomfort, or any sense of, this is my favorite, personal responsibility for anything that's ever happened in history. Anybody that's ever, you know, studied history in any sort of serious way knows that you feel a range of emotions. And 70% of the time, those emotions are not positive, you know, emotions that make you feel good about the world. The goal of education isn't, you know, to tell you that, you know, the world is sunshine and rainbows. The goal is enlightenment. The goal is some deeper understanding of humanity. And that's what, you know, you hopefully are trying to get across to students.
This is what's so perverse, right? Because it is this entire backlash was shepherded in under the cover of critical thinking, and the left is sort of trying to indoctrinate people. Right. And I want to just play you this little clip from Jonathan Cox, who's this sociologist I spoke to, who I was really just impressed with, who he was talking about what he's trying to do in the classroom, right? Like with these two classes on race that he had to cancel because of this law. Take a listen.
I try to bring in lots of different perspectives and encourage students to do so. So, I mean, like, for example, we talk about something like cultural appropriation. I might present one article, you know, that talks about it and saying, like, this is what it is. Here's why it's really negative. And another article that presents a completely different view. And then we'll talk about it in class so that students, you know, I don't want them to just swallow stuff. And I actually tell them all the time, like don't take what I'm saying just to be the pure 100% truth, right? Like, go out and do some research on your own. I want you to be critical thinkers. So I really try to actively fight against that caricature that you kind of expressed about what people think of in my classroom. And I also don't go in leading with my opinions. I very rarely, almost never share my own opinion, right? I'm much more interested in the thoughts and ideas that students are bringing with them.
I mean, that's a guy who's not gonna, who's not didn't teach.
Right.
Two courses at the largest state school in Florida because of the DeSantis law.
Right. You know, the fascinating part of me is, was it only 2 years ago that there was this notion that kids on campus were too soft and, you know what I mean, needed to be coddled and you know, this, that, and that. And now we have literal laws saying that. We have actual laws, not, you know, beliefs, not ideas, but actual on-the-books laws saying that, you know, students, you know, in the most recent case, in an AP class of all places, you know, are somehow too sensitive to be exposed to ideas that, you know, give them a sad. You know, it is, you know, utterly ridiculous. And it's so clearly not education. The point of it is not education. I'm a teacher, too. I teach down at Howard University. I expose my kids to all sorts of things from all sorts of perspectives that I do not hold myself. There is no way in the world I could be a black writer and say, I will never read anybody that's racist. I'll never read anybody that's sexist. It just, you couldn't live. You couldn't practice your craft if you were like that, you know?
I mean, the irony is, like, you and I have, there are people, and I'm not going to name them, who, like, you and I have talked about, like, writers we like or don't like, writers who, like, whose politics we don't like, but you're like, yo, that guy can write.
But the craft.
That's a good argument.
And you have to do that. Like, you have to, you know, and even if you completely disagree with a person, how will you know what you disagree with if you don't read them? If you don't read them seriously, how will you know?
The thing, and then the one layer deeper than that that I find, and I don't know if people have looked at this, but I spent some time on this, like, the Florida law. It's not just that, you know, there's the education aspect to it, but there's also a degree to which it is essentially stipulating a civic creed officially for the state of Florida that is an ideology. And so here's, like, an example. This is a thing that you can't teach in Florida. Mm-hmm. Under Florida law now, although the law is currently enjoined. Such virtues as merit, excellence, hard work, fairness, neutrality, objectivity, and racial colorblindness are racist or sexist, or were created by members of a particular race, color, sex, or national origin to oppress members of another race, color, sex, or national origin. Now, you may or may not agree with that as a thesis.
Right.
But that is now the official state creed of Florida that you can't say that racial colorblindness was invented as a means of furthering racial oppression.
Right. I don't understand that at all. I mean, I really, honestly, you know, when I read that, it sounds like somebody else who was an activist wrote that and fed it to the legislatures. It's so weirdly specific.
Completely
you almost
agree.
Can detect the hand of somebody else there working. You know, no need to name names, but... It's absurd. It's absurd. And it's, you know, just another highlight for why people like that, you know, shouldn't be involved in the kind of decisions that are made in a classroom.
Just to step back for a second, where do you, you know, you wrote this, I remember writing this really good piece for The Atlantic about Trump, where you call him the first white president, sort of somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but making the point about, again, how whiteness is constructed.
That was the point.
Only in relation to the backlash against
that was the point.
The first black president, could there be a white president in the way that we understand whiteness, right? It's in contrast.
Right.
we had this moment in 2020 amidst the pandemic and George Floyd's death in the aftermath, and these historic, by all metrics, I mean, just people counting in the streets, like maybe the largest civil rights protest we've ever had in this country. This incredibly strong backlash against it playing out in places like this. And now here we sit in 2023, just a few weeks after the death of Tyree Nichols at the hands of Memphis police. And where do you see things in this kind of push and pull?
Believe it or not, I'm kind of excited. And here's why. The history of this country in terms of these backlashes is that they generally come and are generally the most ferocious when the forces that would like to maintain the status quo are most afraid. You can't understand redemption without understanding Reconstruction, and without understanding Reconstruction as an actual threat. You can't understand the backlash that came after the Civil Rights Movement without understanding how much certain people perceive the Civil Rights Movement as an existential threat. And I think it's the same thing here. You gotta, you know, take a second and, you know, step back. If you look at the culture and you look at who's present and you look at who has the authority, you know, like, you know, I hate to, you know, come close to home, but you look at, like, say, a movie like Wakanda Forever that is on the verge of making $1 billion. This matters because people look around and they see who is holding place. It was the same thing for Barack Obama. The idea that the equivalent of American royalty was held by somebody who only generations ago, their very conception would have been illegal. This, you know, this disrupts the conception of what America is, and it frightens people. And so you get backlash, you know what I mean? And so I actually take it as a sign of strength, you know what I mean, for where the movement is right now. But we always knew this was gonna happen. I mean, the expectation that, you know, the war would just be won and that would be it, you know, it just, you know, was always fantasy.
Yeah, and sometimes those, I mean, those backlashes can be dangerous, too.
They definitely can. And I don't want to diminish that.
Right, yeah.
I'm not diminishing that at all.
And I think, you know, you're seeing it in schools. You're seeing it in certain ways in which, like, criminal justice laws, right. Backlash against bail reform, all these different places where progress is made, you can see the backlash politics being marshaled
and
incredible.
And I just think that's because the idea is sticking. Like, how does the 1619 Project end up in an executive order? Like, think about that. Like, what piece of journalism can you remember ending up in an executive order?
I mean, no piece of journalism I've ever produced has any...
Me either, brother.
Has any president ever cared that much about one way or the other?
Me either. And so what that means is people are afraid.
Right.
That means something is sticking in the minds. They're actually using the levers of the state. It doesn't mean it's not dangerous. I want to be really, really clear about that. But it's also a statement of how threatened they feel and, you know, the effect that some of this work has had.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I do think, like, I'm constantly trying to keep these two tracks in my head of the material and the ideological.
Yeah.
So it's like there is so much force and momentum behind these ideas. They're not new ideas. They're old ideas about racial equality, about deconstructing whiteness, about taking apart. And then I look at the material and it's what's the racial wealth gap?
That's a great point.
Have we closed the life expectancy gap between black and white people?
Right.
We have not. Is it staying the same?
It is not.
And I'm always wrestling in my head, like, what those two things, because it does feel like the ideas have an ascendancy and they do have a force and they are scared because they are.
Right.
And then you look at the material aspect and it's like, it feels like a less encouraging story.
I think, though, those on the other side understand that one undergirds the other. That if ideas of white supremacy become less ingrained in the body politic, then when folks look around at the jail system, maybe they actually really do start asking questions. When folks look around at who's poor and who's not, maybe they really do start asking questions in a way that they didn't before. I think of it like the foundation of a building. You can chip away, chip away, chip away, and you can see progress, you know what I mean, in the chipping away, but the building might still be there. You know what I mean? And so it is that the edifice of white supremacy still is there, even as the foundation, you know, is being chipped away.
Do you think, you know, there's some evidence to suggest that the peak of racial polarization in American politics happens under Barack Obama in recent times, right, just in terms of sorting, that it starts to depolarize along lines of race as you get further away from Barack Obama. People have made this argument, whether it's true or not, I sort of think the data is a little unclear. Mm-hmm. But do you think the post-Trump era that those lines remain as hard as ever?
I don't know. It's a difficult question for me to understand because I have difficulty with that analysis. I think white people were certainly more frightened
under Barack Obama, yeah, or a certain type of, or a critical mass, or a certain kind of white person, was certainly much more frightened and much more politically active. And I think that's definitely true. But the vocabulary of racial polarization conjures the idea that somehow things were more separated. And I think from a black perspective, we would find that hard to, you know, to grok under Barack Obama. I don't think we,
right, yes.
Like,
right.
If you look at, like, I certainly did not feel any more distance. I mean, I think we always felt distance. You know, did we feel more distance under Barack Obama from a black perspective? I don't know that we did.
No.
You know?
You can make an argument there was more proximity.
I agree. And I think that was part of the problem. I think that right there was exactly part of the problem.
That was the source of the...
Yeah, I think, like to the extent, like, I wish we could come up with another term besides polarization.
Yeah,
but
yes.
Let's just say, I prefer the term fear. So let's just say for a certain sector of white America being afraid, I think that proximity was a problem. And this goes back to what we were talking about before. I actually think the symbolism of it was a problem, which is not the material. You're correct about that. You know what I mean? But I think the symbolism of it still threatens people because they correctly identify that it's the symbolism that undergirds all of it. You know, there's a reason why, you know, folks came up with ideologies to justify slavery.
I was thinking about the symbolism today with Ilhan Omar. I mean, when you talk about soft power, which is just a nice sort of like polarization, it's kind of like a not my favorite term. But, you know, what people think about America, and it's so wild to me, the cultural supernova nuclear fusion that is America. Yeah. Where you go in around the world and, like, you hear American pop songs, mm-hmm, and you see American movie stars and American shows, much of which, a disproportionate amount of which is generated by black people, mm-hmm, right? So, like, African-Americans generate, mm-hmm, a crazy pie chart of, like, right, what is global pop culture.
Right.
But to have Ilhan Omar as this symbol of, like, here's a woman who came to the U.S. as a refugee fleeing war, black Muslim woman, mm-hmm, she wears hijab, who's a member of the U.S. Congress, and, like, what that means symbolically, and then to sanction her and what that means symbolically.
Yeah, I don't think that's a mistake.
Right.
You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, performance. One thing that I think about, you told me this years ago, and I don't know if you remember this, but you said, what you often say to people who say voting doesn't matter, is that if you look at wealthy people, they have some of the highest voting
rates.
They
all vote.
So if it doesn't matter, why are all these wealthy
people
voting?
Vote. Go look at the voting, you know, go around Palm Springs and see what, you know, voting, they're voting.
And I feel the same way about this conversation about symbolism, right? Why do the people with power care about it so much? If it has no power, if it's ultimately irrelevant, why are they so focused on it? You know what I mean? Are they making some sort of tactical error? Are they, you know what I mean, foolish and, you know what I mean, not paying attention to the right thing? Or do they understand that this is the thing that actually undergirds much of the material power that they enjoy in the first place?
What are you working on these days?
Why would you do that to me?
You don't have to tell me.
I'm working on Superman.
You're working on Superman.
I'm working on Superman. That's why nobody sees me. I'm working. It's called Superman. So, I mean, you can imagine how big of a job that is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate symbol, right?
Yeah. I'm working on Superman. I'm trying not to say anything else, but yes.
Where do you see, I guess, this question of sort of this back and forth, like, mm-hmm, the force of these ideas? Like, I've been really stuck. I've felt a little, I mean, after Tyree Nichols' death, I keep running through this thing.
You watched the whole video, didn't you? You had to quit your job, right?
Yeah, we did, although we told people on the staff that you don't have to.
Yeah, I haven't watched it.
Yeah. It's just incredibly upsetting. But the thing that I keep coming back to, and I'd love to hear what your thoughts on, is, like, I feel this feeling of, like, okay, if you make me the king of Memphis for a day, or the head of the police department, or I have a magic wand, like, you know, solve it. And it's like, there are certain problems in American life where I feel like I got a beat on that, mm-hmm, and then that one, I feel like there were times where I did, mm-hmm, but now if you said, okay, here's the magic wand, go fix it.
You know what I think the tough thing is? It is, if crime rates go up, the answer is we need more cops and we need to put people in jail. If crime rates go down, that's because we have a ton of cops and we have a lot of people in jail. You know, the answer is...
It's a one-way ratchet.
It's always the stick. It's always the stick. And it's really, really... I mean, this is like, you know, you talk about things that make you pessimistic. When I look at the entire edifice of criminal justice in this country,
yeah,
I mean, we really did something. We really, really did something that's going to be really, really hard to unwind.
Although, to go back to your point before, there really has been some progress in unwinding.
Oh, tell
some
me something good. I'd love
there,
to hear.
I mean, there has been reduction in incarceration rates. There's been bail reform that has worked in a lot
of
places.
True. That's true.
But it is under assault now.
Yeah.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, what a great pleasure to have you here.
Hey, man. Thank you for having me. Thank you again for that introduction.
Of course.
Our take from our studio view of the president's speech tonight was that it was unusually interactive. Lawrence O'Donnell used the word combative, described it as the most combative State of the Union speech that he'd ever seen. That was our impression from here. What was your impression in the room, and what did you make of the president's remarks?
Absolutely. I may not have served as many terms as or have as much experience as other members, but this is my, fourth or fifth now, and I have never seen a State of the Union that was so disrupted by members of either party. Even under President Donald Trump, we saw nowhere near the level of jeering, interruption, etc., that we saw by some of, I want to say the extreme elements of the Republican Party, but they are now being embraced and uplifted as the center of the Republican Party. It's really shocking. Even the things that the overall Republican Party refused to stand for, paying public school teachers, public health policy, basic education policy, raising the wage for some of our lowest paid workers in the United States. This should be really basic stuff, sky is blue kind of stuff. And the Republican Party, I think, really showed the country who they are tonight, that they have been taken over and that this isn't some right wing. This is the ethos of the modern Republican Party.
We did see the president focus on economic issues and sort of bread and butter issues and working families, middle class families, practical issues throughout almost the duration of his speech. He talked a little bit about Ukraine. He talked a little bit about the Roe versus Wade decision for a little bit. He spent considerable time on police violence and trying to get some sort of police reform. But we really saw him talk about nuts and bolts stuff, kitchen table stuff. Wages, dignity of work, jobs, healthcare costs, access to healthcare. I have to imagine that in your district, given its profound diversity, both ethnic and economic diversity, that has to be welcome, just in terms of that being such a large focus of the president's remarks.
Yes, absolutely. I do think that the forcefulness of some of the language that he used, calling out Big Pharma by name, really naming these caps that we have passed on the price of insulin, on out-of-pocket costs, it is powerful. And this is some of the most animating issues that touch the material reality of everyday Americans. I think he did a good job of that while also not letting off corporate greed. As he called out the profit margins of big oil. I think that it was definitely impactful, and it was surprising, I think, even to some of us, compared to some of his past State of the Unions.
Let me ask you about something I just referenced a moment ago, but let me just ask you in detail about what you thought about the president's lengthy, and I thought quite empathetic, remarks about police violence. He talked about how members of law enforcement are risking their lives when they put on the shield, and that they deserve to come home just like the communities they protect. But community members deserve to come home too, and there have been too many people killed, and it's not getting better fast enough. And he spent a lot of time engaging with Tyre Nichols' parents, who were there in the gallery watching, and we know so many other family members of people who've been killed by police were there tonight in the room to pay witness. What do you make of the president's remarks and about what he's substantively proposing?
I was surprised by the president's remarks and his focus on reform, focus on justice, and really his focus on centering the families that have been so deeply impacted by police violence and police brutality, and really centering this discussion around reform. If you contrast that with his speech just a year ago, where, this two-dimensional frame of fund or defund, and it was, we're going to fund the police, this is a very different conversation, and one that advocates have been asking for a long time. See what is happening on the ground. See see and acknowledge the reality that our communities are experiencing, and that this is a problem that has gone unaddressed for far too long. And so for him to stand up there, to name, you know, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which in and of itself, advocates already believe that it doesn't really go far enough to address the core underlying issues. But still, for him to name this legislation, it's a long way from just a year ago, where it was really just about how much more money can we pile into these local departments in order to fix this issue. I also think it's an acknowledgement of the fact that this isn't really connected to funding much at all in terms of how we actually lower these instances of horrific violence in communities. And so I thought it was encouraging. I know myself and some other members were kind of waiting for the shoe to drop. We felt like there was kind of this wind up and that there was going to be a but. And I think we were very relieved and surprised that there was no but, that there was just an acknowledgement that this is actually a problem. And we have not really heard a president do that in such a straightforward way in a long time, if ever, in modern politics.
It's a really astute point, particularly talking about the distance that President Biden himself has come on this issue, perhaps in his own personal understanding, but also in the way he's willing to talk about it. Thank you for that. And thank you for being here. New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it's always a real pleasure to have you with us whenever you can be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We live from the head down and not the feet up. And I'm adorned with a frown that's making this up. And I'm fine, fine, under cloud nine. Yes, I wear the lamb's wool, the feet of burnt brass. And the wool defies gravity like the nature of a gas. And I'm fine, fine, under cloud nine. Twist my cloud and it rains. And when it rains, oh, it pours. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the energy will absorb. Power for the metal. Been chosen to wear the conscious cloud, and I'm fine, 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 under cloud nine, nine. I be a chameleon and wear it bone straight, but it's so much stronger when it's in its natural state, and I'm fine, fine.
Oh, got to fight for what we need. We the people got to save the air we breathe. We the people got to keep Bear Monsanto from controlling food seeds. We the people got to keep our own minds free. We the people got to take some action now. Cause if we wait on a pipe dream, quick scheme, Superman, woman in the last scene, save us from the main thing while we do our own thing, hit in the sand, problems unseen, it won't matter anyhow. We the people got to stop the racist plan. We the people got to drive hatred from this land. We the people got to make it so democracy is more than a word. We the people must ensure the poor are heard. We the people got to stop wars, corporate greed. Cause if we wait on a pipe dream, quick scheme, Superman, woman in the last scene, save us from the main thing while we do our own thing, hit in the sand, problems unseen, it won't matter anyhow. We the people got to fight for what we need. We the people got to save the air we breathe. We the people got to keep Bear Monsanto from controlling food seeds. We the people got to keep our own minds free. We the people got to take some action now. Cause if we wait on a pipe dream, quick scheme, Superman, woman in the last scene, save us from the main thing while we do our own thing, hit in the sand, problems unseen, it won't matter anyhow.
It is, I promise it's gonna get better.